Case 21-5733, Awais Haji Mohammed versus USA. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Hawley, you may proceed for the appellant.
Your Honors, may it please the court, I'm Michael Hawley. I represent Mr. Haji Mohammed in this appeal. And if I could, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
Okay, thank you. Now, this case stems from Mr. Mohammed's effort to withdraw his guilty plea under a binding deal for 35 years when he came to find out that his sentencing, his statutory mandatory minimum, actually would not be 35 years. Now, he came to find this out because the law changed in that instance. First Step Act came out, his mandatory minimum would be 17 years. We went to defense counsel, he went to Mr. Komisar, said, I want out of this 35-year deal because my mandatory minimum is not 35 years. Mr. Komisar told him, no, that's a bad idea. If you do that, they'll resurrect the state murder charge. It's a bad idea. Now, Mr. Mohammed forged ahead. He rejected that advice. And that's a very important fact because it shows through his actions that to him, the state murder charge was not central to his decision making. What was central was the mandatory minimums for 924C. We forged ahead. Mr. Komisar really did an extremely poor job, and they lost.
Now, Mr. Haji Mohammed did testify before the district court in the Fair Step Act motion for that,
yes, Your Honor.
For that one, and he in that testimony was addressed whether or not he was considering the mandatory minimum as relevant to his decision making. Is that fair to say
yes.
that he testified as to that in that hearing?
Mr. Mohammed talked about whether the 35 years was important to him, the mandatory minimum of 35 years. Yes, he talked about that. And Mr. Komisar talked about it too. Mr. Komisar said these mandatory minimums are important to plea negotiations. That's what it's all about.
My understanding of the district court's ruling is that he had a chance to weigh the credibility there and determine that the mandatory minimum really wasn't driving the decision. The decision I think the district court made was that it was based on, it was a negotiation between the government and his counsel that ended up at 35 years without regard to the mandatory minimum. Is that fair to say that's what the district court ruled?
That's what the district court ruled. I don't think that was a sound
approach. So why don't we afford deference to that credibility? If he was making a credibility determination of whether or not your client really believed the mandatory minimum was important.
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's several problems with the approach the district court took there. Now, one is, back at the time, he certainly did not decide that. At the time, in 2018, 19, he said, this is just not a good enough reason. And he said, I think you're pretty forthright with me. Maybe not in everything, but you're pretty forthright with me. He did not make a credibility determination at that time. And then when we come back, we have an affidavit from the client. It's consistent with all the contextual facts. You know, he tried to withdraw his plea when he found out it wasn't 35. He said a lot of things. He said, you know, Mr. Komisar persuaded me to take this because he told me that this was the mandatory minimum. And it all makes sense because...
Are we really focusing, though, on the seriously new mandatory minimum of 17 years? Or do we have to look at the fact that when he entered his plea in the first place and he was told it was 35 years, it wasn't. It was actually 33. What impact does that have on all of this?
Yes, you're right, Your Honor. I mean, it was actually 32, yes. It was actually 32. And everyone had told him wrong from the first day. And he would know from the first day that they're telling him it's 10 for the first, 25 for the second, 25 for the next. When they come up with a number of 35, he would know this, that 35 would be two of these counts. As Mr. Komisar said, this is what was driving the negotiations. So there was everyone was wrong, and everyone gave him the wrong advice. And this is central to Rule 11, and this is central to a voluntary and knowing plea. The case law is very uniform in this. In fact, the government had to look long and hard, and they never found a case where someone was misadvised about their statutory mandatory minimum, especially if it's tied to a term in the plea agreement, or it's logically correlated to a term in the plea agreement, and they said, oh, it doesn't matter. We all think it's a great deal, and we just don't believe you. Now, the judges can't just say, that's self-serving testimony, so I don't believe it. I don't think there's a basis for Judge Crenshaw to go beyond. There's no basis for him to say, I don't believe.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, isn't there evidence in the record as to what the, how the number was reached at 35, that it, the government and I believe his counsel also said that they were just negotiating a number. They weren't looking at what the mandatory minimums were.
Sure, Your Honor. They negotiated a number, and at that time, Mr. Muhammad already knew that 35 was two of his 924Cs. This was overhanging his whole case. Three would be 60, two would be 35. So when they come to him and say 35, he knows that already. Mr. Komisar said he was never happy with this. It's not like he said, oh, 35, great, I'll take it. That's a great number. You know, he had to fight with him about it. Mr. Muhammad talked about how it was persuaded to me that this is my mandatory minimum. Mr. Komisar never denied that. If Mr. Muhammad were lying about that conversation, Mr. Komisar should have corrected the record. I'm sure it happened. It's the absolutely natural thing to happen, to have to tell your defendant, your client, that, look, this is the mandatory minimum you can get for these counts. That's one important reason why it's a good deal. In fact, if everyone had realized it was 32 at the time, well, maybe he would have settled for 32. That might have happened. That might have happened. But 3 years is a difference. 3 years is a difference in someone's life. And it's for him to make the decision. He was definitely on the fence. He was fighting this like so many people do. I put the statistics in my reply brief. 35% of the people that get stacked 924C sentences under the old regime go to trial. That's a massive number of people going to trial in federal court. The usual number is less than 3%. You know, hardly anyone goes to trial normally. It's quite common for someone in this position to go to trial. Mr. Muhammad was taking that same route. He was on the fence. He got pushed off the fence using this line of persuasion.
I want to circle back to the evidentiary hearing that the district court had, and you say that he didn't make a credibility finding, but didn't the court say that not only was he relying on Mr. Haji Muhammad's demeanor, he also, based on the testimony, believed that he had buyer's remorse and that he was influenced by the fact that one of the co-defendants had been acquitted on the cricket store robbery. And so wasn't he taking all of that into consideration? I guess my question to you is, why should we now come back when we weren't at that hearing? The judge was at the hearing. He did observe your client's demeanor. He made some conclusions based upon the demeanor and these other factors and said that you weren't driven by this 35-year, the mistaken 35-year mandatory minimum that folks told you about.
Yeah, I really think there's a fundamental problem with making this all turn on a factual credibility finding. I mean, this is, the judge is supposed to estimate what is a reasonable probability. And you can't just say because it's self-serving, I don't believe it. You look at objective, contextual facts. In these cases, people win these cases all the time by saying, look, I was fighting in stubs. I was fighting, I was going to trial. I tried to withdraw afterwards for another reason. In Hogg, for example, the term in the binding agreement was indirectly linked to the amount, to the statutory mandatory minimum. You look at these factors and you're making a mixed finding of fact and law. What's a reasonable probability? The judges can't come in and say, I don't want to decide if there's a reasonable probability. I'm not making this mixed finding of question, this finding on a mixed question of fact and law, which is reasonable probability. I'm going to make it all a factual finding. I'm going to take all the power myself. I'm going to say, I don't believe you. I just do not believe you. And so it's a factual finding, and I have the final word on it. I don't think the judge can do that. And that's kind of, that's pretty much what he did here. And he did it years after the fact. He did it a couple of years after the hearing even happened. When we submitted an affidavit, when Mr. Komisar admitted an affidavit that, you know, they can be understood together in a way that totally supports our case. And Mr. Komisar says he wasn't happy with it. I told him not to do it, but he insisted anyway because he didn't buy my reasons. The whole background of objective facts support Mr. Muhammad. And the judges can't say, well, I know what's actually in your head, and I don't believe it. And so anyway, on top of that, Your Honor, we do have the ineffective assistance claim. And, you know, under there, the prejudice standard is even lower. I mean, we have to prove there's a reasonable probability of winning under that very low, fair and just standard. You know, Mr. Comenzar has no excuse for what he did. He said in his affidavit, I did not care what the mandatory minimums were. Smith versus United States requires him to care about that. When Mr. Muhammad wanted to withdraw his plea, he had an extra incentive to find that out. That's all the time I have for now, if there's any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, William Glasser for the United States. The district court correctly denied the 2255 motion after considering not only Mr. Haji Muhammad's testimony at the prior hearing, as well as his statements at the sentencing hearing, but also all of the facts that were known in this case, the undisputed facts, as represented by his former counsel, Mr. Comenzar, and the facts that were reflected in the record. Those facts, some of them have already come up today, include the fact that counsel for the government and for the defense negotiated the 35-year deal before deciding what counts Mr. Haji Muhammad would plead to. That was, as the district court concluded, a good deal for him, considering that he was facing a state first-degree murder charge with a likely sentence of 51 years before he could receive parole, as well as an additional, in sum, 19 federal counts in this case. The parties agreed on that 35-year deal and then went back and decided which counts Mr. Haji Muhammad would plead guilty to. His decision to seek to get out of that plea came only 11 months after his guilty plea, after which time his co-defendant had been acquitted of one of the two charges to which he pleaded guilty, count 13. The district court correctly concluded that that was indicative of buyer's remorse. In addition, as the government points out, one of the witnesses to the murder that was involved in the state proceedings had died subsequently. So that when you take that 11-month period, the fact that his co-defendant had been acquitted and that one of the witnesses had died, that all supports the district court's finding that in fact it was the motion to withdraw was based on buyer's remorse, not on a misunderstanding of the mandatory minimum. Coupled with that, the district court reached the conclusion that Mr. Haji Muhammad's representation that his decision to plead was based solely or primarily on the mandatory minimum, the court concluded that wasn't credible. As this court has already mentioned, generally the credibility determinations of a district court are owed deference. All these facts together support the district court's conclusion that Mr. Haji Muhammad was not entitled to Section 2255 relief. Now, if I may briefly address something that hasn't yet come up during this argument, and that is the standard that this court needs to apply. The district court applied a more lenient standard to the Rule 11 issue than it even should have on 2255 review. As we explain in our brief, the appropriate standard under TMREC is the miscarriage of justice standard. The district court applied sort of an ordinary direct appeal standard to the Rule 11 error and concluded that there wasn't even a reasonable probability that but for the misstatement of the mandatory minimum that the result would have been different, his decision to plead. He certainly can't show a miscarriage of justice as he must do on collateral review when he hasn't at any point denied that he committed any of these crimes, and the only error that occurred here was a minor misstatement of the mandatory minimum.
Minor?
Your Honor, it was minor in the grand scheme of things. 3 years could be very significant in some cases, but in this case, when facing a...
36 months.
Yes, Your Honor, but when facing the state charges for first-degree murder and a guidelines range of life...
The court said you got a sweetheart deal. You're nuts if you think you didn't, and that's all... Very, very true, but the district court isn't the guy facing 36 more months than he, if he had been properly advised in the first instance, would have been facing.
Your Honor, and I certainly don't mean to suggest that those additional 3 years wouldn't be significant in some cases. Certainly that could be, in some cases, that could be a non-harmless error under Rule 11. But in this case, especially under the miscarriage of justice standard, it does not rise to the level of something that warrants collateral relief, because taken as a whole, when facing a guidelines range of life imprisonment, these state first-degree murder charges that are very serious, the difference between that incorrect statement of the mandatory minimum didn't affect the overall benefit that he received. And as I mentioned earlier, the parties had already agreed on that 35-year term, irrespective of the counts to which he pled guilty, which influenced the mandatory minimum.
Is it? Now, I realize that you don't think that, there's any credit to be given to what the defendant says his own motives were, but casting that aside for a moment, is there not some real harm to a defendant who pleads under circumstances that are not correct, so his plea arguably was not knowing and voluntary? Isn't that in itself an injury?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be, and it, under that, that's the sort of second question, whether or not there's a constitutional violation here. So putting aside for a minute the Rule 11 violation, which has to satisfy that higher miscarriage of justice standard in order to rise to a constitutional violation, there's a separate due process requirement that a guilty plea be knowingly and voluntarily made. And this is where the government, we argue in our brief, based on the Supreme Court decision such as Brady versus United States, North Carolina versus Alford, that failure to fully understand all of the consequences of pleading guilty is not enough to show that the plea itself was not.
There's a difference between failure to fully understand and failure to have been given the appropriate information, the accurate information?
Your Honor, I think there could be a different.
I mean, everybody blew it on this one.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court didn't know what the mandatory minimum was. The counsel didn't know. The government didn't know.
That's correct.
And it's almost incomprehensible why none of those people knew.
Your Honor.
Surely the defendant wasn't supposed to know.
Your Honor, they should have known, but I think the context of this case explains why it wasn't on anybody's radar. Again, as both defense counsel and the government agreed, there were three 924Cs here, plus all the other counts, plus the state counts. They weren't thinking about mandatory minimums when they reached the plea deal. They were thinking about a bottom line term of years sentence, and that was what drove the negotiations here, and that's why counsel, neither for the defense nor the government, were closely looking into what exactly the mandatory minimum should be. Should they have done so? Yes, but
it's always worrisome when you say it's not what drove the negotiations, because, of course, the defendant himself wasn't really doing the negotiation. His lawyer was doing it for him, and his lawyer was proceeding on a false premise, just like the government counsel was, just like the court, which wasn't involved in the negotiations, of course, was.
Your Honor, the false premise was only on one of the three 924C counts. So the false premise was that discharge count should have been treated as the first rather than a brandishing count. So that was either a 7 or a 10-year mandatory minimum. There were then two 25-year mandatory minimums consecutively stacked beyond that. So again, in the grand scheme of things, particularly when facing that state sentence, that wasn't, although they were laboring under a misapprehension as to the mandatory minimum for that one count or the ordering of those counts, it didn't affect the overall negotiations to the point that the district court could conclude that he would not have entered the plea but for the misstatement of the mandatory minimums.
Well, isn't there some evidence that's more contemporary in time that at the time of sentencing that the defendant actually said that my lawyer has told me that 35 years is it, and so I realize that that's all I can get, and so that he was relying on the 35-year representation?
Your Honor, he actually said that at the time of the guilty plea, not just at sentencing. So he said that he recognized that that Mr. Komisar had gotten him a good deal with the 35. I'm not sure that he actually said he realized that this was, if he said that it was the best he could get, he wasn't speaking in mandatory minimum terms, because again, the mandatory minimum on all of the counts was actually 57 years.
Well, but my point in referencing the testimony at sentencing was that by the time of sentencing, he knew precisely which counts he was pleading guilty to.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there were only the two counts that were at issue at that time, and at sentencing, he said that the 35 years was the best that he could get. Now, the district court referred back to an evidentiary hearing that it had that was on a different issue, but it didn't consider that more contemporaneous statement from the defendant that he thought that 35 years was the best that he could get.
Your Honor, if I'm understanding the question correctly, I don't think the district court erred by not considering the testimony at the sentencing hearing or his statements at the sentencing hearing, because those weren't under oath. So the court in denying 2255 relief, referred back to that earlier evidentiary hearing where Mr. Haji Muhammad was under oath. But I also don't think there was much inconsistency between his representations at the hearing and at the sentencing. Because at...
I just want to stop for a minute. Are you saying that statements that a defendant makes at sentencing that are not under oath, the court can't take into consideration?
Oh, no, certainly not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But in making the credibility determination, the district court was focusing mostly on the representations under oath. By the time of sentencing, at that point, his motion to withdraw his plea had been denied. He was clearly frustrated with the whole process. He didn't want the court to accept the binding plea agreement. And so I don't think that there was anything wrong with the court not specifically addressing those representations. But as I said, I think those representations he made there were very similar, if not identical, to the representations he'd made previously, where he said that it was the mandatory minimum was what was driving this. And he did put that fact in dispute. But the district court, relying on having heard face-to-face that evidence, the district court, when denying 2255 relief, said, I don't find that credible, particularly in light of all the other things in the record. And if I could just briefly address the standard that applies to the constitutional question, the due process question of whether a plea is knowing and voluntary. In the reply brief, Mr. Haji Muhammad cites the Stubbs case and suggests that the constitutional standard is simply whether or not there is a reasonable probability that the defendant would have entered the plea. But if you look closely at the Stubbs case, actually the court concludes first that in that case, the plea was not knowingly and voluntarily made under a more traditional standard like that applied by the Supreme Court in North Carolina versus Alford, and did not suggest that the sort of the prejudice standard that it would apply to a preserved claim under or a plain error claim on direct appeal under Dominguez-Benitez. This court was not suggesting that just by showing prejudice, just by showing that he would not have entered the plea, that he can satisfy the constitutional due process standard for having an unknowing and involuntary plea. Just wanted to briefly address that point. And one other point that I'd like to address is that Haji Muhammad's counsel said the government couldn't come up with a case where a misstatement of the mandatory minimum didn't affect the decision to plead or didn't entitle the defendant to relief. It's true we didn't come up with a published one, but we did cite this court's unpublished decision in Wilburn. And there the misstatement was not with respect to a mandatory minimum on an offense, but the consecutive nature of a revocation sentence that went along with the sentence. And in Wilburn, the court concluded that there wasn't a substantial likelihood that the defendant would not have pleaded guilty had he known that the revocation sentence would run consecutive. So it's not exactly on point, but it is very close and very similar. But the government acknowledges that this case is in some ways unique. Many times, the sort of mixture of factors that goes into this determination is different and leads a court to conclude that the defendant should be allowed to withdraw his plea if it's at that stage, or that his plea was not knowingly and voluntarily made. However, in this case, under these facts, the district court did not commit any clear error in finding Mr. Haji Muhammad's statements incredible, and in concluding, based on the state charges, all the federal charges, et cetera, that he could not satisfy the standard for relief under Section 2255. If the court has no further questions, we ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glasser. Mr. Hawley?
Your Honor, as the government is talking again, as they did in their brief, about a miscarriage of justice standard. That standard has no place here. We raised a constitutional claim of not knowing involuntary plea. We didn't base it on a Rule 11 violation. They're doing that to change the subject because they really have no good case on point. Yes, they cited the Wilburn case. That case is so different. Unpublished case. It's unpublished for a good reason. They made a mistake about whether this was going to have to be consecutive, and the judge followed through with the mistake at sentencing. Gave him the benefit of the mistake, but decided to run it consecutive. So there was no harm. And in fact, that guy got the very minimum he could get under the law. And then when the panel issued the unpublished decision, they said, look, he doesn't even argue there's a reasonable probability this would have made a difference to him. I've written thousands of words on this about why there's a reasonable probability of a difference here. So, And that's the very best case they could get from any circuit. I mean, there's no other circuit, there's no published cases. This case would be an extreme outlier to say a defendant can be told the wrong mandatory minimums by everyone, and it can be directly linked, at least by logic, to a binding term in the plea agreement, and say, oh, well, it's fine, because we all know it was a good deal.
What would happen if we agreed with you and said that this wasn't a knowing and voluntary plea? What happens to the defendant then?
Well, we'll go back to square one, Your Honor.
If he gets what he asks for, is he going to be sorry?
Well, I guess he might be, and I'm saying this is just exactly what people were talking about in the United States versus Hogg case. The government was saying, don't let him out, or they're fighting against it, but saying if he gets out of it, it's going to be worse for him. Mr. Hogg came out better. I think in this case, the government, it does not ring true that this was such a great deal. Otherwise, the government would have just said, fine.
So what exactly are you asking for?
Well, our primary relief we want is for him to be relieved from the plea agreement, or withdraw his plea. That's our primary position.
What's your secondary position?
Well, I think our second position is actually the claim that's easier to win. I mean, I don't want to disparage the first claim, because I really do think denying this claim would be a decision that would really be an outlier in all this case law. But I mean, the ineffective assistance claim is even easier to win, because I just can't imagine how he could not have won his motion to withdraw his plea if he could have gone in there to the judge and said, look, everyone told me the wrong number. I wasn't even told the right number. It was a clear Rule 11 violation. It's a core Rule 11 violation. I want to withdraw my plea. I think there's at least a reasonable probability he would have won that issue. And if he was denied it, he would have won on appeal just like Mr. Hogg did. And, you know, the defense, the other prong of that is proving deficient performance. I don't think you can say the defense lawyer doesn't need to know the statutory mandatory minimums, especially when your client is saying, I want out of this deal. Find a way for me to get out of this deal.
But to do that, don't we have to just say we're not going to defer to the factual findings that the district court made?
Your Honor, well, especially, I don't think for either one. I mean, as I was talking about before, I don't think this is strictly a factual finding. I mean, the judge was supposed to make a finding on a mixed question of fact and law. What was reasonably probable to happen? Under Strickland, Strickland itself describes that finding, the reasonable probability thing, it's a mixed question of law and fact, reviewed on appeal de novo. So it's not strictly a factual finding. And I mean, for the ineffectiveness claim, I don't think that's affected by that finding of fact. And you know, the judge, what he had a hearing on back in 2019 was a question of, you know, what is your reason for trying to withdraw your plea right now? It wasn't what's the reasonable probability you would have done back, you know, a year ago when you took this 35-year deal. That's the real question. That wasn't even the question before the judge at that hearing. The question was, what would you have done if Mr. Komisar had said, well, you know, the deal's for 35, your mandatory minimum would actually be 32. I think there's a good chance from Mr. Muhammad's behavior, his whole course of conduct, being on the fence with this, having to be persuaded, if he had been told that, he would have said, I'm resisting. I'm not taking this. And that was the real question for the judge to answer. So that's all I have. And we ask that you, primarily, that you vacate the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Raleigh.
Thank you.